Father, we thank you for Ronnie's presence here, what he has to share today. I pray you give us open hearts and open minds, and Lord, that we would be mindful of your love for your people Israel, especially as we are living in these end times. We pray in Jesus' name, amen. Ronnie, would you please come up?
Good morning, everybody. I know that you're there because I heard you. I can't see much because of the projectors. Thank you, Pastor Ken, for being here. I'm always happy to be back to Spokane, not my first visit. I know that Ken and Jamie Ortiz are friends of Israel, friends of ours as well. I know that Calvary Spokane are friends of Israel. We need friends. When I started doing this many years ago, it struck me how much support Israel has among evangelical Americans in the USFA, and I took a mission upon myself not just to share Israel with Americans, but to bring back home to my people how much support we have from the Americans, because we don't get to see that on our media. You complain about your liberal media, we can give you lessons about liberal media in Israel, and people in my country do not know that we are not alone. They do not know that there are many supporters of the state of Israel. So this mission that I took upon myself is kind of a, almost like a two-edged sword, if you can say that, in a positive way, is to share with you about my country and to share about your support to my people back home. Some of you just stare at me. It's English with a funny accent that you're listening to, and the accent is not going to change, all right? So please get used to that. I'll go for about an hour or so, and my plan for this morning is to deliver a message which is not easy to share and not easy to understand. I will dare to say it's not something that you hear in a Sunday morning service in churches in America, but there's so much interest and so many people want to know what is going on. I do want to share some of it with you. Here is what I'm not going to do this morning. I'm not going to engage in propaganda. There is so much out there, so much deception, so much disinformation. Confusion is serving everybody. Sometimes you need to do some cleanup and you need to cut to the chase and go to the main points that people need to know. I cannot be totally objective, please understand. After all, I'm part of the conflict over there, but people need to know the facts. And many people approach me and say, listen, we want to make a case for Israel. We do not know how to stand for Israel because we are lacking that kind of education. So my point for this morning is to give you a short history overview. Because when you speak about what happens today, not knowing the roots of the conflict, you're missing the big part of the story. If you just zoom in and you speak about Hamas's atrocities, and you speak about Israel's retaliation, and how poor are the Palestinians in Gaza, and what about the hostages, you're missing part of the story, an important part of the story. So please allow me to go back a few decades and take you step by step by some key points and turning points to get to know the story just a little better. Go for about an hour, and let's start now with the most painful issue that we are facing for the first time ever. We speak about the hostages. Do understand, Israel is a small country, about 10 million people. Everything is very personal. We know people that were killed. We know people who are held as hostages. We know nothing about their condition. It's a struggle that no other nation in the world was ever facing. It's unprecedented. And for that to happen to Israel, and we are a strong country, that requires an explanation. How come that for one day, October 7th of 2023, everything went wrong? That may happen to other countries, not to a nation that knows danger and knows warfare and knows emergencies and is prepared to defend itself. How did it happen? We need to understand the mindset of Israeli leaders. You will not hear from me that we are always right and always wrong. We need to know the facts and the details, and that will be my plan. So we'll speak about what happens in Gaza recently, but we need to give a short overview as well. Look at that slide over there. Looks like fireworks, almost like the 4th of July, but this is not fireworks. You see a barrage of rockets flying into the central part of the country coming from Gaza, and this is the countermeasure, the Iron Dome. Picking each one will intercept one of those, and almost no damage is done. When you see that, it's quite amazing to see this picture. Looks like a happy occasion, huh? No, we speak about the death, we speak about destruction. As I said, it's not an easy message for me to deliver, and not one for you to understand. I may be a little emotional. Please understand how deeply you're all involved in what's going on. And that will be the plan. So let's start, and let's start with some history. We have to, otherwise we are missing part of the story. Let's speak about the Gaza Strip. Lots of information will come up and down the screens. I'm not very disciplined as a speaker, so you have a triple challenge for this morning. Understand my accent, try to follow what I'm sharing with you, and try to synchronize it with the screens. Good luck with that. It's not going to work. Let's start by giving you some data about the Gaza Strip, a very small area geographically, the most crowded place on the planet. You see the information over there, 2.2 million people, mostly refugees, living in terrible conditions in a very small and condensed area. You do see how small that is, even comparing the whole state of Israel, that we're not such a big state. That will be the Gaza area. That will be the focal point of all the tension in the region. And let me submit to you, what you're witnessing now is not a limited local conflict. It's a global conflict. We are there to hold the front line in behalf of the Western world, I should say the Judeo-Christian world. But it's not just our concern. We speak about something that goes way beyond the borders of the Middle East. And for that reason, the whole world is watching, the neighborhood is watching, and that conflict can end in only one way. We have to deliver a message. We won't have it again. Hamas will be destroyed. It will take some time, but we are determined. And we do that not just in our behalf, we do that in behalf of all what we should call the civilized Western world, and the world is watching. And therefore, we don't have that many choices or options, and we retaliated brutally. But maybe it's about time, because until recently, our retaliation was very mild, and Israel always retaliates. I'm challenging you to go and check in the archives. You give me one example that Israel initiated a war in the area. Never. Israel is retaliating, and this time we are in a condition like never before because of the hostage situation. So some data about the Gaza Strip. The important part for today's message is that since 2007, Hamas is controlling the Gaza area, and that presents a challenge to the state of Israel. Here is a timeline to try to focus on who controlled the Gaza Strip in what times on its short history, and we'll go and speak about each such era, and I'll take you almost step by step to explain that. Let's start what happened from 1949, but go a few years earlier. Here's the story. The story is that in 1947, it's a given situation in the country. A British Empire has a mandate over Palestine. That would be the name back then. The mandate was given to them by the League of Nations when they conquered the area. And in 1947, Great Britain decides we are going to leave this area. Great Britain won the Second World War but lost the empire. They were totally exhausted. They did not have any resources to invest. They had 90,000 troops employed in Palestine. They want to go home. But by then, there was a problem. Two people fight for the land, the Jews on one side and the Arabs. Forget about who's right and who's wrong. It's a given situation. And since the British understood that leaving the area without trying to find a settlement will lead to a massacre and bloodbath, they asked the United Nations, just born 1945, April 1st, Fool's Day, huh? A good day for the UN to be born in San Francisco, was invited to try to deal with the issue. And the UN sent over a team of 11 members, and this team was supposed to meet with leaders, Jewish leaders, Arab leaders, bring them to the table, try to negotiate. Today we speak about the two-state solution. It's not a new concept. That's what they tried to accomplish. Two countries, one for the Jews, one for the Arabs. The problem was that when the Arab leaders were invited to the table, for some reason it doesn't go back, so I have no idea why not. Anyhow, let's just stay with that. It does go back. Okay, I just learned something new. It's a Hebrew-speaking computer. That must confuse me. All right, so we speak about an invitation that was sent to the Arab leadership that turned it totally down. The answer was, this land is Muslim. The Jews have no connection to Israel. Think about that. The Jews have no connection to Israel, and therefore we are not negotiating. Once the British army is leaving, we are going to throw the Jews into the ocean. The Jewish leadership was more than anxious to discuss and to negotiate. These are the years after the Holocaust. 6 million Jews perished in Europe, maybe more. If the world had offered a homeland for the Jewish people, we could not say we are going to decline. And therefore, the idea to negotiate to find a two-state solution, that was in vain. So the delegation, quite frustrated, decided that the only way to solve the problem is by dividing the land into two. They brought the plan back to the General Assembly, and the General Assembly voted for it on the 29th of November 1947. And by that idea, Resolution 181, or the partition plan, between the River Jordan on one side and the Mediterranean Sea, two countries will be created, one for the Jews and one for the Arabs. That was the plan. Jerusalem will have a special status. It will be an international city, an enclave of Jerusalem and Bethlehem, because these cities are too important to the whole world, not just to the Jews or the Arabs, and therefore now to have Jerusalem in the heart of a conflict, it will be governed by the United Nations and not by any of the two states. That's the plan. The tragedy is that today, 76 years later, that's what we try to accomplish. If they only took that plan 76 years ago, think about the amount of life that we could have saved. Think about the amount of resources and devastation and destruction. 76 years later, it's on the table once again. What a tragedy, what a shame to wait such a long time to try to find that solution. So that would be the opening point or the starting point. The UN made the decision. The Jewish people accepted that decision. The Arab world, not just the local Arabs, said we are not going to have it. This is a Muslim country. And Great Britain said, your problem, guys, we are going home. And sure enough, the British left the country and the Arab armies invaded into Israel's territory. I do want to clarify some things on the map over there. That would be the plan as was presented by the United Nations. We speak about a two-state solution, two countries for two people. When the Arab armies invaded Israel, in our retaliation, we were able to conquer some of the land that was allocated to the Arab state by the UN. Let's call them Palestinians for the lack of a better term. I can prove to you in many ways there was no, there is no Palestinian nation. But that's beside the point. If 5 million people call themselves a nation, who am I to tell them that they are not? It's not going to help to solve the conflict in any way, so we're going to call them the Palestinian people from that point on. So we're able to conquer quite a lot of land that was allocated to the Palestinian state, and when the war was over and the armistice was signed, that would be the new map in the area. The brown areas over there will be basically a territory that Israel was not taking. The yellow area is the state of Israel, and these are the West Bank on one side and the Gaza Strip on the other side. Now, just a minute now. How come the country for the Palestinians wasn't born? I just told you, two countries for two people. If I'd ask you the question, and you don't know your history, and forgive me for saying that, many of you don't know your history, your answer will be because you, the Jews, conquered the land of the Palestinians, and for that reason, there is no Palestinian state. Right? Wrong. Here's what happened. This area over here, the West Bank, the King of Jordan sent his army inside seemingly to help the Palestinians. And after the war was over and the armistice was signed, this area was occupied by the Jordanian army. Had the King of Jordan said, I'm going to withdraw and give the land to the Palestinians as he was supposed to, there would be a Palestinian state today. The King of Jordan, Abdullah I, decided to stay and to actually annex that territory. That's the West Bank. Let's use the biblical name, Judea and Samaria. The Egyptians came to help from the Sinai Peninsula into the Palestinian territories area, and after the war was over, they occupied the Gaza Strip, and they refused to pull out and hand it over to the Palestinians as they were supposed to. And therefore, the Palestinian state wasn't born, not because of Israel. Had the Egyptians and the Jordanians pulled back and handed the land over to the Palestinians to say, we came to help you, that's the land that you have, we lost some of it for the Israelis, celebrate your independence, we would be in a totally different condition today. So next time you hear about the Jews coming to steal Arab land, absolute nonsense. The Jordanians stole that land from the Palestinians, and so did the Egyptians. So the Gaza Strip basically will be the outcome of the war in the area, an area which is isolated, Egypt on one side, Israel on the other side, filled with refugees who fled into the Gaza Strip area. That will be the condition in this area when the War of Israel's independence came to an end in 1949. We call that the War of Independence. They call it the disaster. Basically, they call it the Holocaust sometimes. That's how they see the disaster that they suffered, as they see that, during the War of 1948. So this will be the map of Israel until 1967. The Gaza Strip area is in Egyptian hands. I'm taking a side track for just a minute. When you speak about refugees, it's a very clear definition. Definition is made by international law. Definition is made by the United Nations agencies. A refugee is a man that lived permanently in a certain location and had to leave because of the atrocities of war, etc. By the world definition, if you lived in a certain place for 5 years and longer, you would be qualified to be called a refugee, which means that the world is going somehow to sustain you, is going to help you with provisions, but it's not a permanent condition. You need to try to fit in the new country, you get a job, you send your kids to school, you integrate into, you don't inherit that position for your children and grandchildren. After the Second World War was over, 50 million refugees were wandering through Europe. You don't hear about them anymore. About 10 million Germans had to leave German territory, not Germany proper, in Poland and the Ukraine, and go back to Germany. They're not refugees anymore. In the case of the Palestinians, the UN created an agency called UNRWA, and they made a new definition, 2 years. If you stayed in a certain place only for 2 years and you left, you have the right to be called a refugee, and you can inherit that position until the end of time. So today we speak about the fifth generation of people which are called refugees because of that strange definition. Why should they try to get a job when the world pays them salary which is higher than what they can make in the working market around them? Why change that condition? You know, Gigi Hadid is a refugee, poor Gigi, all right, and her sister. By definition, you never lose that title of a refugee. And most of those refugees left their homes even before the war started. Because before the war started, the Arab leaders delivered the message. You Palestinians come and take shelter in our country. The mighty Arab armies are going to throw the Jews into the ocean. You may be caught in the line of fire. You will be in danger, in harm's way. Come to our country just for the time. And after we throw the Jews to the ocean, you go back home to take their homes, which are much nicer than yours. 85% of people which are called refugees today, 76 years later, were people that left their homes because of that invitation, even before the war started. And many of them went to Gaza. Well, they lost the war. They're not going back. You show me one place in the world that refugees were repatriated. It doesn't happen. You find yourself a new home, a new family, a new nation, a new culture, and you blend in. That's what happens, and it's a very unpleasant outcome of every war that was ever fought. Refugees, unfortunately, it's part of the tragedy. So Gaza is inhabited predominantly by refugees, basically, that keep that condition. Another sidetrack, if I may, now it's in Egyptian hands. Let me say one word about apartheid. People accuse us that we're in the apartheid state, right? Israel is in the apartheid state. You go to Yale and to Harvard and to Princeton, they all know that we are in the apartheid state. How stupid can one be? I mean, we have a population of 10 million people. 20% of them are Arabs. They are Israelis just like I am. They're voting for the parliament. They have members in the house. One of the Supreme Court judges is an Arab. They play sports with us. They work everywhere they want. They're just like any other Israeli. So to call us an apartheid state, this is the easiest thing, so to speak, to disprove. Just come and visit the country. Arabs are part of our society. There are doctors in hospitals, and there are pharmacies. They're everywhere. To be honest with you, not that much intermarriages of Jews and Arabs. But there's no such provision. You can do whatever you want. You can live wherever you want. Go to date, get your job, get education. There are no limits of what you can do as an Arab in Israel. An apartheid state? Let me tell you what was an apartheid and still is. When Egypt controlled the Gaza area, it was filled with refugees, and these people had zero rights. They did not have a citizenship. The Egyptian government was not even educating the kids. They did one thing, supply them with weapons to carry on the war against Israel. You go to Lebanon today. You go to refugee camps in Lebanon. They are treated worse than dogs by the Lebanese government and Hezbollah, the Shiite militia. You go to Syria, refugee camps. Those Palestinians are treated worse than anything by the Syrian regime. Apartheid, that's apartheid. Not in Israel. There's only one state, one law, and everybody is equal in the eyes of the law. So when sometimes people say Israel an apartheid state, once again, you're either an idiot or an anti-Semite. These are the only two possibilities because we are not. So next time you hear that accusation, and this is so easy to prove, you don't have to be that intelligent, just come and visit, come and see. So Israel is not an apartheid state. Egypt was, and Lebanon is, and Jordan is, and Syria is, in the way that they treat the Palestinian refugees that they've invited to come to take shelter in their homeland back in 1948. So meanwhile, a few things happened. In 1967, Israel won the war, and the Gaza Strip was in Israeli hands until we started negotiating with the Palestinians over a peace process, and yes, we initiated the negotiations. 7 times, Israel put an offer on the table, 7 times. A Palestinian autonomy, a Palestinian semi-state, it was always turned down, always, without even presenting a counter-offer. Usually, there was an opening condition. Here was the offer. You don't like it? I understand. Give me a counter-offer, we'll start to negotiate. Never happened. And therefore, it started when we made peace with Egypt. In 1979, Israel and Egypt made peace, and Israel pulled out from the Sinai Peninsula all of this area not on the map, including the Gaza Strip. We told the Egyptians, listen, we're going to give you back all of Sinai and Gaza for peace. The president of Egypt cleverly said, I don't want Gaza back. Gaza will be your problem. And therefore, making peace, very cleverly, I have to say, making peace with Egypt, we pulled out from the Sinai Peninsula, but not from Gaza. Gaza remained in our hands, and yet we initiated the first round of peace talks with the Palestinians. And that was right after the Israel-Egyptian peace accord was signed. It opened some possibilities and some options to negotiate with the Palestinians. Egypt did not want the Gaza Strip. That's a fact. In 1988, the King of Jordan, the late King of Jordan, Hussein, made a statement. My grandfather, he said, that occupied the West Bank that was supposed to be a Palestinian homeland was wrong. It was illegit. I'm relinquishing any demands for the West Bank. Anybody can have it. So now we have two pieces of property, just like in 1946, so 47, that nobody wants. The Egyptians decided they don't want the Gaza Strip. Jordan was not interested in the West Bank once again. Well, now we can talk about a piece of property to people in the area, and that started negotiations that Israel initiated, and we signed a deal. The deal was signed in 1993 in the White House, September 13 of 1993. It will be called later on the Declaration of Principles. It's not important. The important thing is that Israel was willing to recognize that there is a Palestinian people. They have some rights for land. We offered an autonomy, not statehood, at least not yet. And it looked like it's going to work. Because guess what? It's logical. Common sense finally prevails in the Middle East. Let me tell you what. The Middle East and common sense are not good friends. Nothing is done by common sense. Everything is done by religious zeal. It takes a while to understand what's the motivation of the other side. Part of our tragedy is that we see the world by projecting our own image, our own values, and we think that everybody has the same values. Says who? Sometimes it's a big misunderstanding until you begin to understand how the other side thinks, what's the motivation, what Islam teaches about the Jews. By the way, kill them all. I'm not making it up. Go to the Quran. It's there very clearly. So once you start negotiating, it looks like it's going to work because it's for the best interest of everybody. So we pulled out from the Gaza area. We pulled out from Gaza, leaving behind a small enclave of Israeli communities. The rest was given to the Palestinians, basically. And we thought, this is step one. It's going to work because it makes a lot of sense and peace is around the corner. That was supposed to be the opening stage. We are pulling out from land. The Palestinians will have it. And they're supposed to build a country, to build an economy, to stop the acts of terror against Israel, to stop instigating the kids in schools against the Jewish people. You should see those textbooks. You know, one way to measure a society, I kid you not, if you have a chance, if you want to know something about a country in the world, try to find textbooks and see how they educate the children. That will tell you all you need to know about what this country thinks, feels, and how they bring up the new generation. You go and check out the textbooks in the Palestinian schools and then check with Israel. All right? It's not the same. It's not the same message. So now we started the peace process. And as I covered all of that, so let's go a little further. The Palestinian autonomy officially was founded July 1st of 1994. Yasser Arafat drove a fancy limo from Egypt into the Gaza area. And that's what started a new era in Gaza story. Now the Gaza Strip is in the hands of the Palestinians, except for this small enclave. Now the whole idea was that we are going to give you more land, and if we see that you deliver and you're really seeking peace with us, we'll give you more and more until all the land, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, will be in your hands. That was the plan. And since we signed it and we meant it, we pulled out from the area. And guess what we got in return? In a very short time, the Gaza City had developed a whole industry of manufacturing rockets and manufacturing mortar shells. And before we understood what was going on, the town of Sederot, a Jewish town, right here is everyone, was shelled by the first rocket, and we understood that something is wrong here. But we respected the agreement, so we could not pursue anybody in here. That was a place under Palestinian sovereignty. And things were getting worse and worse. And in 2000, for example, another peace talks took place between our Prime Minister Barak and Yasser Arafat, and Clinton was still in office. It was in the White House, and they produced absolutely nothing. And Israel decided we are going to make one more step, because the whole world was pressing us to say, listen, you have to appease them. Just give them a little more. It will have to lead for peace, because peace is good for everybody. World says who? So we made this agreement or concession, and under a very hard liner like Ariel Sharon, Israel decided to leave the Gaza area. The reasons were to see if the Palestinians do mean business, to try to show the world who is the aggressor. Israel initiated another process which will be called the disengagement plan. Disengagement means in that regard that we are going to leave the Gaza area, and sure enough, in August and September of 2005, Israel completely evacuated the Gaza Strip. There's not a single Israeli in the Gaza Strip since September 11, 2005. The last soldier, the last civilian came out from the Gaza Strip, locked the gate behind him, and this is it. How many times you hear, free Gaza? Free Gaza from whom? We are not in Gaza since 2005. Maybe from Hamas. But most people don't have a clue. So it makes perfect sense. You occupy Gaza, you have to leave Gaza. Well, we did. We did many years ago. So there are no Israelis that live in the Gaza area. We control the borders, obviously. We have the right to see what goes into the Gaza area, because they say it loud and clear. By the way, don't believe anything I'm sharing with you this morning. I cannot be trusted. I have an agenda. I'm biased. Check with them. They don't have a hidden agenda. They say it loud and clear. We are here to destroy the Jews, to destroy the state of Israel. They say it all the time. We just refuse to listen. Because Israel may be the first target, you're next. And so is Europe. And therefore, to fully understand the threat, action is required. Unfortunately, violent action. Nobody wants to think about that, but time is not in our favor. So the whole world is watching what's going on, because we finally begin to understand this mindset. No negotiations, no peace. If you're not a Muslim, you have one destiny, death if you're Jewish, or redeem if you're not even going there. All right? It's a class of population in the Muslim world, but we take it very seriously because they take it very seriously. We simply ignored it for such a long time. It surfaced, it's on the table, it's a religious warfare. Forget about politics. How many times you heard it? It was okay with the Jews. Our problem is the state of Israel. A problem are the Zionists, not the Jews. We live with them together, side by side, in perfect harmony. Nonsense. Jews were massacred in Muslim countries. And you read the messages. The Grand Mufti, that was his name, in 1944, in Germany, good friend of Hitler's, said it loud and clear on Nazi radio, kill the Jews wherever you can. You're pleasing Allah, you're pleasing history, you're pleasing our faith. It's right in your face. It's not the state of Israel. It's the Jews that make this world contaminated. That's what they think. For a while, Israel was trying to make peace with Saudi Arabia, and maybe we'll get it in the near future. Sounds amazing. And we asked permission to use the airspace to make the journeys to the Far East much shorter. For a flight from Israel to go to Japan, for example, you go above Russia, right? And there was a much shortcut. The answer was no, because the very presence of Jewish airplanes on Saudi airspace will defile Mecca and Medina, the holy places to Islam. Do you understand that? Is there any room for negotiation? One party tells you, I'm going to kill you. That's it. Regardless of what you're going to do, I'm going to kill you. How do you make any progress? Where do you go from here? If you come from our mindset, oh, they don't mean that. They're people. We can reason. No, you cannot. Because it's on the religious level, it's a dead end. Now we understand. It took us a long time. We all need to understand what is it that we are facing. Told you, not a pleasant message this morning, all right? So we pulled out from the Gaza area in 2005. And soon after that, they had elections in the Palestinian territories. Arab countries in the Middle East had elections only twice. Free elections, as we have in our country, all right? As free as they can be in democracies. The first time it happened here. The world sent inspectors to see that everything is legit. And two parties ran for the elections among the Palestinians. One was the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization that focuses on the Palestinian nationality. And the other party was Hamas. Hamas is Muslim Brotherhood. Hamas does not have a political agenda, just a religious one. Hamas believes, like most of the radical Muslims, and ISIS learned from Hamas, not vice versa. Hamas inspired ISIS, right, for their atrocities, and then they had a chance and they showed us exactly what they can do. That should be the order of things. Hamas did not copy what ISIS did. Hamas invented the system. ISIS was the one to use it. So when we say that Hamas is ISIS, we mean that, and that's a fact, unfortunately. So we do speak about a mindset that we begin to understand. And since the U.S. was overseeing the whole thing, we told Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, if you let Hamas run, they may win. It's going to change the whole situation. And she said, we believe in democracy if that's the will of the people, so that's the will of the people. Guess who won the elections? 75% majority. When the Arab people in the Palestinian territories had the right to speak up, that's what we want, basically. Hamas and the Salafists, and they knew what they're voting for. How many of you will vote for a party in America that all they offer is oppression, fanatic religious atmosphere, zero rights, as we understand that, for women and for minorities, abuse of children, almost no education? Would you vote for such a party? Do you understand that? It's a different mindset. As long as you promise us that your ultimate goal is to kill the Jews, we'll vote for you regardless how poor and miserable we are going to be. Who thinks like that? Well, they do. And do not believe a word I'm saying with you. Listen to them. They say it all the time. We are going to stop. We're not going to stop. We'll try again and again until the Jews will be killed and then the Christians. That's a message in every language that you can get it. Elections. Hamas wins. And when Hamas wins, the PLO that was in power refuses to surrender the weapons, and that leads to a civil war in the Gaza area. And Hamas wins the civil war in the Gaza area. And from 2007, the new masters of the Gaza Strip is indeed Hamas. It's going to be a game changer in many ways because we did not believe it's going to be so easy for them to take over the Gaza Strip. But they did it because they were prepared, fully armed, highly motivated. And how do you win such a war? You take your countrymen, the Palestinians from the PLO, and you throw them for the rooftops, and you put the bullet in the kneecaps. Until today, hundreds of people move around with wheelchairs because they had the bullet in the kneecap. That's how you win a civil war. So for 2007, the Gaza Strip is Hamas. And keep in mind, the Gaza is bordering with Egypt as well. You see, the world wants us to take good care about the people in Gaza. Why should we do that? I mean, these people are committed to kill us all. Show me one example in world history that two people were at war and one is supplying the enemy with everything that they need. Food and water and fuel and pharmaceutics. They can come and take medical attention in Israel. They come to work in Israel to make money to support the families because the money Hamas is getting, they use for terror to build the tunnels, not to create an economy. Who would do that? We do. We don't want to have starving people on the other side. We tried to coexist somehow, and very naively, we supported Hamas in Gaza with almost everything they needed. But you have the right to control what goes in. By the way, what about the Egyptians? They are the dear brothers of the Palestinians. How come the world is not demanding from Egypt to send in food or to take care about Gaza? Not even once. It's only Israel. You're in control and you take care about... No, we're not. We left the Gaza area. Yes, there is a blockade on Gaza. We have the right to check what goes in and out. Ask the Egyptians. They are your brothers and sisters. They should take care about you. The Egyptians are not idiots. They know all too well that supporting Hamas, it's almost like putting a bullet in your own head, because Hamas is Muslim Brotherhood, and in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood is outlawed. All right? The Muslim Brotherhood is an illegal movement in Egypt. And Hamas is Muslim Brotherhood Palestine. So why would the Egyptians support Hamas in any way? So we do that. But we have the right to check and see what goes in. And there was a gray area. Some of you who are farmers, you do know, if you mix some fertilizers together, you can make quite a good bomb. So if you tell them you cannot have phosphorus coming in to fertilize your land, the whole world will say, oh, these people are going to be hungry. They need the phosphorus as a fertilizer. Yes, but they have potassium and another ingredient. You can make a great bomb out of it. So are you going to let them take it into Gaza, or you're going to stop them? You don't understand our dilemma. We opened the gates and invited 1,000 Palestinians from Gaza to come and work in Israel. And they are making Israeli money 10 times more than they make in Gaza Strip. Now we know these people came to spy on us. They were leading the attack in October 7th. We fed them, and that was the reward. So you do understand that never in the future Palestinians will come to work in Israel. We learned our lesson, and that was one of it. So from that year on, it's in Hamas's hands. Let's have a word about Hamas. And once again, it's easy to find. You go and you Google and you read the charter of Hamas and you read who is Hamas. They do not hide their intention. And therefore, it's all out there, and you learn about this group of terrorists, and of course they call themselves maybe freedom fighters. But who are you freeing exactly? You kill your own people. So what kind of a freedom fighter are you? The only motivation they have is a total destruction of the Jewish state and the Jewish world as well. So that's how they treat each other. We speak about people committed to world jihad, not to Palestinian independence, to world jihad. It's a religious agenda and not a political one. So Hamas is not fighting for a Palestine. Hamas is fighting for Islam. And Hamas is fighting in the most radical way for Islam. If you embrace world jihad, that means an everlasting war. You show me one demonstration in the world ever that Arabs were rallying for peace. Show me one. You won't find it. You show me one such occasion that was peaceful. You won't find it. And I'm not being biased. Muslims do not rally for peace because Islam is in a stage of war with everybody. You need to understand that. Now we know. Took us a long time to get to that condition because it doesn't make sense. We can reason. We are people. No, you cannot. That's a motivation. Lives don't matter as long as we need to accomplish that one, and that will be a destruction of the state of Israel. You see, for 24 hours, they had a chance to show us exactly who they are. And they did show us who they are. I do this job of guiding for nearly 40 years. And I kept telling people that I had the privilege guided to say, listen, Hamas and ISIS are the same. People say, oh, no. They are Palestinian. They're good people. If they are the same, how come they never did what ISIS did? Because we were there to stop them. And we had failed for 24 hours. Beheadings, rapings. What kind of a twisted mindset will put an infant in an oven and turn it on? Who behaves like that? They do. And they are proud of that. It's the GoPro cameras. It's everywhere. You do understand what we are dealing with. And I'm telling you once again, it's not a limited geographical issue. We speak about the global problem. That's why the whole world is involved in what is going on. So that's what Hamas is up to, and that's how they operate. Read Article 13 from the Charter of Hamas. It will give you an idea. What is it that Hamas believes in? For example, the only solution, as they say, is just with jihad. So what's the point in negotiating? What's the point that we try today to bring the world to some end by talking to? It's not going to work. And if you were not convinced with this one, please read the following one. I underlined just the bottom of it, but when you read the all of it, you think to yourself, who are these people? Who thinks like that? Israeli soldiers were standing at the doorstep of Temple Mount and were shouting that Muhammad is dead and he left daughters behind. What exactly are you insinuating here? That we're going to rape all the Palestinian women in the Gaza Strip area? That's what you can learn out of it. No, we don't. They did. And they raped quite a lot of women in October 7th. We have among the hostages about 30 to 35 young women that may be released because there is a negotiation goes on. And one thing that we know for sure, Hamas will not release many of them because they will be pregnant by now. Think about that. Coming back home after almost 5 months and you're coming back pregnant. You understand the problem here, huh? It's going to happen, almost no doubt. So once you begin to understand their motivation, the way they act and behave, it really gives you some clarity. What is it that you're fighting against? The way they do that to accomplish their purpose is using their own civilians as the first line of defense. The Gaza Strip has the biggest fortified tunnel system in the world. It's bigger than the London Tube, 400 miles of tunnels. And that's where Hamas is hiding, not the civilians. One of the officials was asked, how come you don't let civilians to take shelter from the Israeli airstrikes? The answer was, these are refugees, the UN should care about them, we don't care about them. Right in your face. So those tunnels are used. That's where the hostages are kept, and those tunnels are used in a way that no army in the world was ever confronting such a target. And we are learning as we go, and we do a good job. It just takes a long time. You want to minimize casualties on our side and on their side. And the world is coming to learn how to do that. American military personnel is sitting in our headquarters to learn how to fight such a war. The closest the U.S. ever got to that was in Mosul in Iraq, not even close. And by the way, Lebanon may be a bigger challenge than Gaza is. Where was the money coming from? Who gave the money? Qatar. The real villain in the story is Qatar. The money is coming from Qatar, and they know exactly how the money is being used. Qatar invested in your universities $4.7 billion over the last 10 years. Don't be surprised that you see students in Howard before the war even started, waving those banners from the river to the sea. They don't have a clue what river, what sea. Your bright kids, and they are bright people, are educated in the wrong way. It's not our problem. We know what we're dealing with. It's your problem. Private universities, private money, I understand that. What about public universities? It's your taxes supporting that. And nobody said anything until the shameful hearing of the presidents in the Congress, right? Three times Ms. McGill was asked, is speaking about the destruction and killing of the Jews is violating the protocol of Howard University. And she hesitated. Depends on the context, she said. Which is in the right context, Jewish lives don't really matter. Amazing. In America, the 21st century, how can that be? And in European universities, money talks. And when you go to the president and put a check on the table, you can do almost everything you want, including indoctrinating bright young people in the very wrong way. And it happens everywhere. And we were simply caught unprepared. It's a good thing, by the way, because now we cannot ignore it anymore. Measures have to be taken. You know that the donations to Howard were cut in 50%? 50%. They take a hit because that's not what you send your money for. You want your kids to get decent education. And not to justify the murder of babies and the raping of Israel just because they are Jews. We won't buy that anymore. We are not apologizing for anything. We are going to protect ourselves by destroying our enemy. To say that Israel has the right to defend itself, thank you, evil mouth has the right to defend itself. We have the right to take out our enemies. That's what we do, one after the other. Starts in Gaza, maybe Lebanon later on, almost inevitable. Yes, it's about time. And time was not working in our favor. Well, just to get you to know some of the characters in the whole story, the main leadership on the right-hand side, the president of the Palestinian Autonomy, 87 years old, he's going to resign soon, but he refuses to call for elections, which means when he steps down, maybe natural causes, maybe other causes, there will be a bloodbath among the PLO. He refuses to name his heir, and we speak about gangs, basically, fully armed. So that's going to be another problem to deal with, a total confusion and mess after he's gone. And Hamas leaders, Yahya Sinwar is the underground in Gaza, Ismail Haniya enjoys a beautiful hotel in Qatar, and so is Khaled Mashal. These are the main characters who are leading the Palestinian side or the Hamas side. But this is an organization which is well-rooted in other places as well. They have embassies and they have delegations in Turkey, for example. Turkey is no longer a friend. Turkey is an official enemy, a member of NATO, just to remind you. Okay, that's Turkey. And in other places as well, that would be the structure, including the West Bank. We live in a town about a mile away from the West Bank, and Hamas is very heavily invested in this town. So machine gun fire is part of our daily routine. And we can't take it not seriously enough, because what happened on October 7 may happen again. And therefore, we're very careful, and we take it very seriously, and you don't have any other choices, any other option. Well, as I shared with you a little earlier, after Hamas took the Gaza area, Israel has a blockade around the Gaza area, and we can check and see what goes in. And of course, the whole world was in uproar. The people in Gaza are starving to death. The brutal Jewish state is starving them on purpose. We speak about genocide. Now, Israel commits genocide. Do you know that the Palestinian population is the most fast-growing population in the world? We don't do a good job if you really want to commit genocide among the Palestinians. Did you know that in 1967, when it was Egypt, the lifespan was 48 years. It's 76 now. We did that. We built the hospitals and the clinics. Infant mortality until 1949, 22 to 1,000. Now it's down to 4, the best in the whole Arab world. We did that. Genocide? That's how you commit genocide? Nonsense. But these are the accusations, that Israel wants to kill the Palestinians. If you do want to do that, there are ways to do that. But this is the most fast-growing population in the world, in the Gaza Strip area. Amazing, huh? What kind of genocide are we talking about? So we invited some reporters from Egypt to go inside the Gaza area and check out the things, and these were the reports. You have the name of the reporter, the newspaper, the date. Egyptians, they were amazed to see that Gaza is lacking nothing. Food prices are much lower than Egypt, beautiful hotels, beautiful beaches. That was one way to have a countermeasure, just to shatter the world up, to say, what do you mean that Gaza is starving to death? Here are Egyptian reporters giving a report about what really happens in Gaza, 2001. And all that time, money flowed in, money came in from Qatar, and that's what the Palestinian militia was doing, basically, to arm themselves to the teeth. For 15 years, every dollar that was given was not given to the people to build an economy and to improve education. The UN should do that. UNRWA, they're refugees, we don't care about them. That's what they say loud and clear. We did not understand to what level they were able to build that system. That was a surprise. We knew that they are building something. We had no clue how many weapons they were accumulating. And when you go into Gaza now and you see that these are not locally made, we speak about standard weapons manufactured in North Korea, in Iran. How did they get there? We're supposed to control the area. Through Egypt, Egypt, Egypt. It's a win-win. The Egyptians are just turning an eye, and Hamas digs tunnels under the Egyptian-Gaza border. They take a cut. It's a moneymaker. And if anybody, anything can come in, everybody can go out as well. Even now, as we speak, we have a real concern that some of our hostages and the leaders of Hamas will use those tunnels and will flee into Egypt. The Egyptians do not do their job that well. Because pulling out from Gaza in 2005, there was a second part of the deal. You Egyptians are going to watch the border. You're going to find those tunnels. You're going to destroy them. Egypt did not. So we need to consider Egypt as well as a potential problem. Instead of working together, now we are in odds in a way, and we need to work with the Egyptians together if we want to finish the job in Gaza. It's a common interest. So the Egyptians do have some hypocritic policy when they do keep the tunnels open, it's a moneymaker to Egyptian officials. And that should be the first consideration. So tunnels and weapons. And the question is, what Israel did all that time, and how can we allow that to happen? It happens 2 miles away from home. We have a great intelligence. We know exactly what's going on. How come it happened? Well, let me try to answer the question. Prime Minister Netanyahu is in power from 2009, and he adopted a certain policy that looked to be quite successful, and it's a legit one. The idea was this. The whole world was thinking that for Israel to make peace with the Arab world, we need to resolve the problem with the Palestinians. That will open the way. Because once we create a Palestinian state or we sign some peace, then Saudi will be drawn in. And all the other countries, that is the first obstacle. Once we solve that issue, there'll be no problems to make peace with all the Arab countries. It's a legitimate policy to have. The problem was, it was wrong. Because if you ignore the Palestinians and you're hoping that by making peace with the Arab Emirates and Jordan and Egypt, they will pressure the Palestinians to make concessions, it wasn't working. And what we saw about 5 months ago was the complete failure of this policy. Because you see, if you want to negotiate with the Palestinians, who represents the Palestinians? They are divided to the PLO in the West Bank, Hamas in Gaza. And they are fighting against each other. So who are you going to talk to? Somebody that can deliver. Basically, nobody. And that division, we encourage it. We encourage Hamas to be stronger and stronger, to undermine the position of the PLO, divide and conquer. How stupid that was, now we begin to understand. With our permission, money was given to Hamas. It was right on the table. Because we want them to be divided. As long as they are divided, the world is not requiring anything from us. First, resolve your problems and come to the table as one. We don't want them to come to the table. We don't want to negotiate, and the way to make sure it doesn't happen is to support Hamas, to undermine the position of the PLO. It looked like a clever policy for a while, until October 7th of 2023. I do know that Mr. Netanyahu is very popular in America. But if you are the head of state, it's your responsibility. And somebody has to take that responsibility. Somebody will have to pay the price. We paid, definitely, a very high price. The problem is politicians don't like to take responsibility. Military personnel, the chief of general staff, and all the others admitted the following day, it was our mission to protect our people. We had failed. Let us win the war, and then we are going home. I wish that politicians would have the same integrity, because they had failed. The whole idea that Hamas is an asset and not an enemy, somebody built that idea, and that would be, unfortunately, Mr. Netanyahu. And it looked as a clever idea, because it worked for a while. Arab Emirates were drawn in, and Jordan, and Egypt. It wasn't working. Ignoring the Palestinians was a mistake. Supporting them officially just to make sure that the PLO is staying weak as it was and Hamas getting stronger, they are partners. Yeah, they don't like us, they want to kill us, but is it just politics? We're going to give them authority, they want to govern the people, we're going to create opportunities, we're going to let the people come and work in Israel. They would have so much to lose. Why would they lose all of it by attacking us? Because we did not understand the motivation. They don't care about the well-being of the people. They don't care about food to Gaza. They care about one thing, destroying us. That was a mistake. And we demand answers. I'm telling you, after the war will be over, within Israel, there'll be a lot of unrest. A lot of unrest. Politicians don't like to take responsibility, but somebody has to be in charge. And if you are the prime minister, and you hold your position for 16 years, who else is to be blamed for a total collapse of your idea that was quite great for a while? You don't understand my point. And therefore, and I'm sorry to say that right in your face, because I do know that Mr. Netanyahu is very popular among a lot of American supporters of Israel. Until about 5 weeks ago, 5 months ago, I'm telling you, a prominent Israeli leader, a person that was respected all around the world, a world-level state person, and he led a policy that looked like very successful for a while. Everything collapsed. October 7th was a game changer. Nothing will be ever the same in Israel as a result of that. The main threat that we had was tunnels coming from Gaza into the state of Israel. The worst scenario we can imagine was that they are going to dig the tunnels under the borderline. There was a fence over there. And they will show up in the very heart of our communities just to take hostages, to destroy, and go back to Gaza. So to protect ourselves from that scenario, we built a fence. We were trusting electronics. We were trusting fences. This fence has an iron or steel wall that goes about 60 feet lower to the water table. If you go any deeper, it's water over there. So we thought that we are protected because we have the fence and we have the army deployed over there and we'll have an alert on time for the army to respond. Hamas was more clever. Hamas had a way to fool us and they did a good job. And let me show that to you in just a minute. We spoke about the role of Egypt with your permission. I do want to take you to this one. There is what we call a perimeter. About 100 meters or 300 feet, if you wish, from the fence into the Gaza area, it was supposed to be a no man's land. Anybody who's coming closer, we had the right to take them out. Well, here's a problem. A kid goes by and he has a ball in his hand. And he kicks the ball, and the ball falls into this perimeter. He just goes to pick up the ball. Are you going to kill this kid? What would you do? You're a soldier, all right? You have orders. Anybody that crosses, you have permission. It's part of the rules of engagement to take them out. Would you kill this kid? Of course not. The following day, a shepherd shows up, and he leads a sheep. And about five or six of them are going astray very close to the fence. He's just going to find his sheep. Are you going to kill him for that? Of course not. And one thing leads to the other. And then you have thousands of them right on the fence, burning tires to create this smoke stream, going closer to the fence to stick to that magnetic bombs that we do not see from our side, they see from their side, just because we didn't want to kill innocent civilians, innocent protesters at the same time. You send your people into work, and these people are spying on the country. All of them find jobs. Where? In the same communities that were conquered and destroyed. So they knew exactly where people live. They knew their names. Hamas's terrorists had a list of names. They knew where each player, where does he live. And you knew exactly where to go. How do you know that? Those people that we provided for the families were spying on us, and they led the attack. We know the names. The motivation was always there, and we hunt them down one by one. We won't stop. We won't stop until the last one from those that entered Israel and created atrocities are going to be killed, and we mean that. Israel stated officially, every Palestinian mother should know, if your son participated in the October 7 attack, you can start mourning because he will be killed. Israel doesn't speak like that usually, until October 7th of 2023. Everything has changed. And once again, it should be a warning, not just to Israel, but to the others as well. So October 7th, that's what made it so successful. They did not understand, where was the Israeli army? How come we are so successful to go in and nobody stops us? It's a good question. Who should we ask? Somebody has to answer the question. Politicians, not just army personnel. They refuse to answer. There will be a lot of inquiries made after the war is over. And people that are blamed will go home. We simply won't take it anymore. There's a whole new mindset in Israel. It's not left, it's not right, it's understanding that something was wrong. So right now, we show a solidarity like never before, just for a while, because we're engaged in a war. After it will be over, the old tension will surface in Israel. There are supporters of the government. People against the government will take to the streets. It won't be violent, never was. Israelis know how to demonstrate peacefully. Yes, we do know how to do that. But that's going to be right after the war will be over. So in October 7th, basically, that's what happened. In 22 different places, Hamas was breaching the walls and the gate. You just detonate the bomb that you stick to the, a bulldozer comes and knocks everything down. and from the Gaza area, not just Hamas terrorists. We speak about simple Gazans. The rumor spread that the borders is open and you can go to the Israeli towns just to loot and to steal and to murder. People came with axes and scissors and hammers to try to kill as many people as possible as a third wave and to steal everything and then to set everything on fire. The level of destruction is unbelievable. So that was that day that we had a hard time to respond. Took us about 24 hours to get our troops together and to throw them out of the country. And then came, of course, our invasion into the Gaza area. So that shows you a little bit of the day. There was a festival, music festival. People simply went to celebrate and to sing and to dance. It was attacked by Hamas. Look at these cars over there, all right? We speak about more than 400 people that were murdered. People that came from the festival. I watched TV one of the days and there was a French commentator that said the following. Well, the Israelis had this festival on the line deliberately so to make the people in Gaza really irritated because they suffer so much in Gaza. How dare you to sing and dance so close to the Gaza Strip? It was a rightful revenge. With my very ears on French TV. Do you understand that? Let me show you this.
Some
right?
Images from kibbutz.
This
Be'eri,
will be. I visited one of the communities hardest about 40 hours later.
Of Hamas.
That was left.
Until
of a house
two weeks
of
ago,
a family
happy families
that
used
lived
to live
in this
here.
Area peacefully.
This was a house with
it's
children
not
playing
just to, I know
out in the green grass.
In the
it was
people,
beautiful.
You know
it was a little paradise.
It wasn't just to come and to conquer, take hostages. It was coming to destroy and to murder and to terrorize, to deliver a message. That's what Islam believes in. And that's what will happen to all non-Muslims, just one house. This community, Be'eri, all right, they had about 100,000 people living there. 130 were murdered, and 30-something are hostages. Take that, multiply that in 22 times, just around the Gaza area, that's how they left that behind before they were able to throw them out from Gaza. Hostages, the most painful issue, I have to say. Some of them were released, and some we freed in a very kind of a military operation that I'm sure they'll make movies about that about 2 or 3 weeks ago, but we still have in Gaza as we speak 134 hostages. More than 30 are confirmed dead. We don't even know what's their condition. Hamas will not surrender any piece of information. By the way, there are prisoners in our prisons enjoying doctor's visits, good food, families are visiting, they can even get education. Our prisoners and hostages, we know nothing about the condition because the Red Cross doesn't do anything to try to get the information. You hear some frustration in my voice for good reason. So once again, that will be the most painful issue in the whole story will be the hostages. And our retaliation basically brought Gaza to a terrible condition. And Gaza today is not what it used to be, and for a good reason. I have to tell you that in the Israeli army, in headquarters, there is a couple of lawyers who are experts in international law. They are authorizing, they have the high authority to confirm any target that Israel is bombing. Unless you know for sure it's a legitimate one, we'll not take it out when we speak about airstrikes. But once you're in the Gaza area and somebody fires at you from a building, the building will be taken down. And guess what? In 80% of the structures in Gaza, 80%, of the buildings. They found arsenals, they found weapons, they found pieces that go down to the metro, as we call it in Gaza. Are there innocent people in Gaza? I don't know, maybe there are. If there are, I don't know who they are. They never speak up against Hamas, for example. And when thousands of people are going to beat up the dead, naked body of an Israeli girl, dragged through the streets of Gaza by Hamas, are the good people in Gaza? I have no idea. But whenever somebody fires at you, he's a legitimate target. And Gaza is in a terrible condition, and we are not done yet. How can you separate civilians from non-civilians when they don't even wear uniforms? You have an AK-47 and an RPG launcher. You leave it in the staircase, and you go to get some food. Nobody will fire at you. You're just an innocent civilian. Somebody else comes in, and he knows that the RPG is there, and the AK-47 is there, and he will use that, and then he goes on his way. He's not a target. He's an innocent civilian. You don't understand how difficult it is to try to distinguish Hamas from civilians if there are innocent civilians in the Gaza area. I would like to bring that to conclusion. Although we did not speak about the global impact, Lebanon and the Houthis in Yemen, etc., but that's where we are right now. Most of Gaza is already taken. Everything goes now to the town of Khan Yunis. Rafah will be the next target right on the Egyptian border. Egyptians are very nervous. Very nervous because they know that some refugees are going to cross into Egypt's territory. That will be their problem. If you refuse to work with us, bear the consequences. And most likely, many of the Palestinians will find a way to go into Egypt. I do want to stop it here because we can go on and on. Just to bring it to the final sentence, much is going on right now. The focus goes to Gaza, and we, of course, understand that. Lebanon will be the next one. The situation in Lebanon is getting worse by the day. It will not end by clever diplomacy. Hezbollah, a proxy of Iran, is firing at Israeli homes. We evacuated more than 60,000 people that left their homes, and our retaliation is minimal. We want to make sure that these people are safe. When they go back home, we don't want anybody to shoot at them just because orders came from Iran or from Tehran. With Lebanon, unfortunately or fortunately, it will not end peacefully. It's about time. Hezbollah is the largest military force in the world outside, let's say, legitimate armies of countries. It's a militia, stronger than the Lebanese army. They have more than 300,000 rockets of every kind, every range, more than Britain, France, and Germany combined. They don't collect it for fun. They're going to use it unless we stop them, and we are determined to stop them. Gloves are off. We tried diplomacy, negotiation. This is it. They have a motivation. Some say they have the right to protest because of the oppression. Well, we have the right to retaliate, enjoy our retaliation.